This episode is brought to you by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will U.S. initial jobless claims exceed $260,000 for the week ending May 10th, 2025? At Interactive Brokers, the yes forecast contract was recently priced at 8%. And the no contract, look at this, was at 90%. IBKR Forecast Trader lets you use exchange-listed future contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on future events like climate change or the economy, politics. You can choose yes or no, and if you're right, you get paid. It's that simple. Interactive Brokers forecast contracts are commission-free, and you earn a dollar for every correct prediction. Plus, you'll earn 3.83 APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon, and you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. The best-informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Check out the data, spot the trends, and make your prediction. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
What a mess. Markets under siege and then reprieve. Powell attack, then a reversal. 1 week policy reversals are a thing, I guess. Markets now pushing policy, Team Trump waking up to reality, and our guest today is Patrick O'Hare. He's from Briefing.com. All this and much more on episode number 918 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, let's admit it. This is no point. This is no way to try to guess where things are going. Every day there's another reason to either buy or to sell or, I don't know, do nothing is probably the right thing to do right now. Seriously, every day there's something, and sometimes multiple times a day, it appears that there's just reason to get the hell out of the markets, and sometimes let's just get right back in, and that is what we're seeing with the results of the daily moves. I mean, you're seeing 4% move post a conversation about President Trump not firing Powell, which he wasn't going to do anyway. But yet the nervousness. And on DH Unplugged, we talk about that this week. John brought up the idea that maybe this is all about a bottoming process. And I don't think that I would say that that is unreasonable. I think there's something to be said about that. And I think that we can go along with that. Well, with all this craziness going on the outside and within the markets, I'm coming to you from the calm and sunny studios of Horowitz & Company down here, right smack in the middle of downtown Fort Lauderdale. I've been here since 87. Love this place. I'm Andrew Horowitz. For those of you that don't know me, hi, how are you? For those of you that are listening for the first time, I'm the host of this podcast, also the co-host of DH Unplugged. Been at it since, the podcast game since 2007. I believe it was, in the business since 87, actually cut my teeth in the financial industry 40 years ago. I know this sounds like I'm an old guy, but I'm not. 40 years ago, when I was 20 years old, started out with John Hancock in, where was it? Bayside, New York, Bayside, Queens, New York. That was, one day I'll tell you the story about that. Oh man, that was some place to work. That was some environment with the people there. There was things going on there that you just wouldn't believe. I will give you one thing that was kind of funny. We were members of a union, life insurance agents back then. That's how I cut my teeth, as a life insurance agent with John Hancock in Bayside, Queens, just north of Northern Boulevard, right down the road from White Castle, which was great. But we were a member of a union. And I was always questioning at a young age, like, why are we members of a union? I don't get it. And then one day it happened. Yes, we went on strike. We were members of the AFL-CIO. We're a subdivision of the Meat Packers. I'm not kidding about this. And we went on strike. And I'm like, excuse me. I'm like 20 years old. I'm like, excuse me. Can you explain what we're doing? Well, we're on strike for this. And I'm like, I don't, this is a commission-based job. I don't really understand. Well, yeah. I said, but I don't understand why we do. Oh, then I get, then, you know what happens then, right? Then I get called that I am a union buster. Or then I'm a troublemaker. I'm like, no, I don't understand. So they want me to go on a strike. I'm like, I am not going on strike. That is the stupidest thing ever. Who is going to care if an insurance agent goes on strike? And moreover, I'm not carrying those stupid signs for an insurance agent. Listen, if you're in a factory or something, it's different maybe. But not as an insurance agent that's commission-based. The stupidest thing I ever heard. Didn't do it. Wasn't going to do it. Decided that's not happening. So, bottom line here is that kind of funny. But in the end, it all worked out. We got here. So, let's talk about the markets, right? I don't exactly understand completely from an economic standpoint. Again, put politics out of the discussion because it's going to cloud your hearing of what we're going to talk about. What we are talking about here is very simple, right? We are talking about the stock market. We're talking about the idea that there is a very significant amount of movement due to policy decisions, both on a monetary, or as I say, the Fed Reserve, and also on a fiscal, a la Congress and the government. Those two things are big drivers of the markets. Other things, of course, are earnings, right? Investor sentiment. And the economy. But a lot of these things are intertwined to a point that you can't mistake them. And even if I agree or maybe even disagree with something, it doesn't really matter, does it? Because it appears that everything that is being said recently from the fiscal side, from the side that either is Congress, the White House, et cetera, is either reversed or changed within days, which tells me, by the way, and I don't think anybody can say otherwise, that they don't know exactly what they're doing. Seriously, they're putting policy into play without the knowledge of how it impacts something else. They're saying things that have to be reversed. But we knew that for the first 4 years of the Trump administration, we know what's going on. So we have a better insight into what to do. And what to do is very simple. We do not react in a way that is going to cause major harm to our portfolio by going in or out just on somebody's comments. But markets are in charge right now. Things have changed over the last 30 days. Clearly, there's a sense of, I would say, pandering that we saw this week from the White House, right? The Treasury Secretary, Commerce Department, clear response to the eroding sentiment and market dynamics that are going on. And in fact, I'm thinking about this. There is something I pulled from Briefing.com. Our guest is coming from Briefing.com. He writes a lot for them and is an analyst, et cetera. I saw something that I thought encapsulated what I've been talking about these tariffs. And this is from Briefing. They wrote, and I quote, "China plays a long game." This is exactly what we heard last time, by the way. "China plays a long game. Its leadership, unburdened by electoral cycles, is willing to absorb economic pain for years to achieve strategic goals. Xi Jinping, who is the president per se of China, his position as de facto leader for life gives China the ability to wait out short-term volatility without the same internal pressures American presidents face. By contrast, U.S. leaders must show results quickly. If a trade confrontation sparks a downturn, political consequences could come fast. Well, before any structural change in the relationship takes hold. This is especially true for a figure like Donald Trump, who must balance economic risks with maintaining a strong political position heading into a midterm year election." So, we'll stop what they had to say, go back to this. We're probably going to see something like a phase one deal again. Remember that one? Right? We had the phase one deal in China, the best deal ever. And by the way, if we had the best deals ever, why do we need to have more deals now? Why are they still doing bad things? If we had the best deal with Canada and Mexico, why were you doing it now and having to put more tariffs on? Or is this punitive for some reason. It doesn't seem logical to me that all the great deals that we did over time with regard to all these countries, the best deals ever, are now all of a sudden crap. They weren't busted up over the last 4 years. In fact, most of the tariffs, much of the stuff stayed on. Not all, but a lot of the stuff stayed on through the Biden administration. So I guess we're going to do something that where it can claim some victory, make everybody feel better, even if there's not a lot of actual change happening. And that is what we're seeing with the markets right now. The reality is hitting this week. The moves we saw this week are definitely from both the White House, the Commerce Department, the Treasury, talking about how, you know, they're going to back off. They're not going to fire Powell. This Treasury Secretary Bessent talked about, hey, we'll get some deal going. Or at least it's unsustainable, was his comments, at the way the current tariff structure is, because basically it's a blockade. The current tariffs are a blockade on commerce. And with that in mind, what's going to happen, I believe, is something like which Bessent said this week, you know, we'll do a deal. It may take 2 or 3 years, but we'll get the framework together, reduce tariffs on the come. Basically, with the idea that we'll fix it one day. And everybody's going to be like, yeah, what a great deal. My God, that was fantastic. Nothing's going to change. Mark my words, nothing's going to change. And that's not so bad. We have the greatest economy in the world as it is. And in fact, most people were doing pretty well. This is a disruption that is going to take a long time for the economy to come back to and heal from. So the housing numbers this week, really poor. We saw numbers from Chipotle, Mexican Grill. We saw things from a few different tech firms. You know, some are good, some are not so good. IBM came out with earnings. It looked like things were, again, good for the first period, but then their outlook is very cloudy and problematic. I mean, it seems very clear when we look at the totality of what's gone in, that the latest round of name calling and putting down Federal Chair Powell with comments like too late Powell and he's a loser got under the skin of the markets. I think that was the last straw. And the midweek statement that we saw that came from the Oval Office really was very good, because words matter, and shaking the confidence of the consumer and the investor, of course, is not in the best interest of the policy change itself. That's a problem. The proposed policy change will hurt with all this confusion. And we had a client webinar this week, and I also wrote a note to clients, something that I think we should share. And this is what I said. I said, here's a takeaway. Attempting to decipher every twist and turn is futile. With policy stance fluctuating by the week, day, and even hour, the market will continue to react to each new headline. The best strategy? Ignore the noise. Focus on stocks with strong fundamentals or sectors, areas, geographic regions that are going to do well. Like we're going to see responses out of Europe and emerging markets, by the way, that are going to try to combat all the problems by additional monetary policy and fiscal policy. We're seeing that the outperformance by emerging markets and developed international is astounding this year compared to the U.S. Whether that holds up or not, if nothing else, it's a sign that there is a bit more of a safe haven that people are looking for outside the U.S. right now. That's important. On another note, a couple of other things I want to talk about. Did you listen to DH Unplugged this week? If you haven't, I would encourage you to do so. We had something really special on this week. We, kind of silly, but we created these lyrics for a blues-style song. And it was based on tariffs and trade and economics and everything that goes along with that. Then we tweaked it a little bit. We found these lyrics and we kind of went through it and went back and forth with the AI engine and asked listeners from there to create some music and singing and voice, you know, to it. And what came back was unbelievable. It was amazing. The song is called The Tariff Blues. It played on DH Unplugged. And JCD Dvorak was flabbergasted, loved it. I recommend you listen only for the point of this. Not that this is a great song and, oh my God, it's not going on the Grammys. That's not, I forget that. It's just all about the potential for what AI can do. And I thought it was pretty amazing. Actually, I can cue this up. But I'm going to hold off. I want you to listen to it on the DH Unplugged. Go over there and check it out. Finally, earnings. Big week about to happen. So far, it's been about the same for most companies. Talking about a good quarter, complaining about the limited ability to forecast ahead, the fogginess, the inability and the uncertainty. Maybe one of two things. Maybe they're just hiding out for now, as it's totally acceptable to do so, right? Considering that all that's going on. But coming up the next couple of weeks, we're going to be seeing earnings from the big hitters. I mean, if the latest fall from the sky high levels of, you know, we still see the biggest contributors to the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ earnings in totality of the index itself are those companies, right? The Mag 7s, et cetera. So what they have to say and actually what they're going to project, it's not so much of what happened before, but it's what they're projecting is going to be very important to the rest of the market. And that's coming up starting, let's see, April 30th, May 1st. I think we have Amazon, we have Microsoft coming up. So there's a couple of big names that we're going to be seeing. And then the rest of the gang too. So over the next 2 weeks or so, big things happening. So I want you to stay tuned for that. Now, before we get to our guest, I want to talk about Interactive Brokers again and ask you and talk to you about another question. You know, I asked you a question at the top of the show. Here's another one. Will the U.S. Consumer Sentiment Index exceed 70 in April 2025? At Interactive Brokers, the YES forecast contract was recently priced at 29%. And you could trade your predictions at Interactive Brokers. If you agree, buy a yes. If you don't, buy a no. Correct predictions earn $1. An IBKR forecast trader lets you use exchange-listed forecast contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on political, economic, and as I mentioned, climate indicators. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors, but the best-informed investors, well, they choose Interactive Brokers. Check out the data, spot the trends, and make your predictions. Go to ibkr.com/forecast and start predicting today. And our guest today is Patrick O'Hare. He's been with Briefing since 1997 and authors the Page One, The Big Picture, Fed Brief, Market View, and Economic Data Reviews columns. That is a lot. He also provides commentary on Live In Play. And if you don't know about Briefing, you really need to check it out because I've been using them literally for I don't even know how long. And I was thinking about it just the other day. What would I do without them? I don't know. But every morning, every weekly Wednesday morning, Patrick is also the guest on KDOW's The Rob Black Show. He is quoted regularly in financial press. He's appeared on CBS Radio, CNBC, CNN, International, Fox Business News, PBS Nightly Report. Graduate of Vanderbilt. Smart guy. So let's bring him right on, shall we? So, Pat, how are you?
Hey, Andrew, I'm doing great. It's good to be back with you, as always.
Good to see you. And as a fair point, just to mention to you, I am a Briefing junkie. I've told people about this 1,000 times. I've talked to you about this 1,000 times. And I had this literal nightmare not too long ago. I'm like, what happens if all of a sudden I don't have Briefing for whatever reason? I mean, what do I do? And I'm like thinking to myself, there's nowhere else to go for the kind of, I'm not trying to plug you totally, but there's nowhere else to go to get the stuff that you do.
Well, I'd love to hear your codependency, and we greatly appreciate it at briefing.com. I can say I've been here for 28 years and it's really rewarding to know that we've got some longtime users such as yourself who find such value in the product because, you know, we work hard every day to make it so that active investors can, be more informed and educated and make really just more confident investing decisions. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I need to do, where's the main, is it Chicago? Where are you at?
Right. Yes. Our headquarters are in Chicago.
I think
in the Chicago suburb.
Can I come up like one earnings season, like just for a day just to sit there on like one of those high pitch, like 20 major earning days and just sit in the corner?
Well, I would hate to disappoint you. It's a kind of an arcane approach to how we do it, but sure, you're always welcome.
Yeah, no, that would be so much fun. Seriously, I know everybody gets their kicks in different ways. That would be, I think, a hoot to come out and see that. All right, last time you were on, here were the show's headlines. This is October 14th, 2024. New highs across the board. Big caps, not the small caps. China, stocks getting obliterated. Okay, wait a minute. We're upside down with that now, aren't we?
Yeah, we sure are. It's been quite the turn of events. We had some continued momentum from that October, from those October levels into year end and even into the early part of January here in 2025. And then, of course, I think as everyone is well acquainted with now, things rolled over in a very concerted way, primarily here in the, in April, trying to get things back here. But it really kind of was born out of the volatility in the policy setting with the new administration. And, I think everyone's just in the same boat of trying to figure out which way is up right now and what's going to happen. There's a lot of answers out there waiting to be had. And so as a result, a market, which is always dealing with uncertainty, is dealing with a really heightened sense of uncertainty right now. And therefore, you've got a lot of trading volatility from one day to the next.
I think the biggest surprise that I could think of was that with all of this, China stocks would be one of the leading areas in the world.
Yeah, there's a stimulus factor at play there, of course. We've seen it in our own market when you've got the notion, never mind the actual stimulus, that you could get some help there, and the Chinese government is certainly needs to be preoccupied with helping that economy recover from its own property crisis. Mm-hmm. and is certainly feeling as if it's under attack right now from the United States with regard to the tariff issues. And I think it's going to be, fairly proactive in terms of fiscal and monetary policy to ensure that, Chinese consumption continues to increase and that economy doesn't, roll over really in the face of all of these tariff issues that have come to light.
Yep. I want to roll back for a second. I want to talk about briefing because I want everybody to understand and give you the plug that you deserve. And then we can go into some of the other stuff in the market trends analysis and politics and all that. Briefing Trader. First of all, brilliant Briefing Trader calls over the last few months. I mean, and obviously the option side of it was like really hot because things, with that volatility, things got really hot. Still don't understand Fibonacci Trader. I feel like there's a guy that's living downstairs in a very, very dark basement somewhere and he's making calls. I try to look up when he does something. Okay, I got my my confirmation at this price. I'm thinking, all right, let me draw some Fibonacci's. I'm like, that doesn't work. I'm not obviously drawing right, but okay. Whoever that is does a great job. I have no idea what they're talking about. But other things like Event Trader, Chart Trader, Options Trader. Talk to me a little bit about how the whole Briefing Trader ecosystem works.
Well, sure. To be honest with you, Andrew, I don't really know what Fibonacci traders talk about either. That's just not my, I'm more of a fundamental analyst here, but in any case, right. So, our trader product, Briefing Trader, makes live trading calls throughout the day. That's supplemented with all of the insight information you get as part of our Briefing Investor product. And our traders are following the markets all day long. Some, very chart oriented. Others, have, good macro perspective. And they're incorporating that into their respective trading calls, giving our Briefing Trader subscribers insight on when to enter and exit positions. And clearly, in these volatile markets, that's very valuable to have that type of experience on board for a number of our traders that are working on the product, been at it for many years and have, seen many different cycles, and certainly traded, through the volatility of the dot-com bust, the financial crisis, COVID, and now obviously with the tariff angst. So a lot of good information there and good calls.
So I have a question for you on this. The actual functional usage of it. What I have on my, this is now, this is just for me, but other people can listen into this. I keep up the, what's it called?
The dual in play.
Yeah, that's what I keep up. Yep. Dual in play. And I put some things on the left that are more general, right? You know, just the eco stuff. And on the right, I have more of all of that. Is there a spot, two things, is that is just trading calls only that you can just put up a, maybe a, another, another tab? And if not, or if there is there someone that says somewhere that shows that where there is open trades, let's say chart trader says going long Apple $5 stop loss, looking for this price, whatever. Fine. Half position. Exactly what that means is also another discussion. Is there someone that has like, where's the open trades and where are the closed trades?
Right. Well, there's no like page, if you will, that contains all of that, you know, information as far as the traders open trades and when they close it. It's all runs through our live in play page. That's where the commentary is featured for our trader calls. So we have those custom tickers. You know, like whether it's CHART for chart or event, EVENT, right?
Right.
Whatever calls they're making and their entry and exit points are going to be profiled on that live in play page. And so that's really for subscribers to our trader product. That's clearly a book, you know, must bookmark page. And it's where you probably spend most of your time. And what you draw out here in terms of the dual in play page, it's a nice feature that, you know, briefing.com offers, is that you can have, you know, those calls on the, you know, left-hand side of the page. And then on the right-hand side, you can get all of the other information that's flowing through in play, whether it's, you know, earnings news, M&A news, ratings changes, just general news items, as well as briefing.com's proprietary analysis of market moves during the trading day.
I think I need a quad in play.
Well, you can set things up in terms of, that's another nice feature, but you can customize your view, right? And so you could do something like that. It's just, there's several options for our users to be able to customize the page that's going to be best suited for their needs.
I got to look into that, because sometimes when you set something up for a long time, you just don't change anything. I need to go and because I would like to, because you only really look past the last 10 items. I'm not scrolling right all the way up and down all the time.
Right. So, you know, I can say, as, you know, someone who's been at Briefing for as long as I have been, you know, I know exactly, I'm a creature of habit. I see, you know, everything that runs through. I kind of just live on the single in play pane, frankly.
Wow.
while looking at our other column pages. You know, there's just a ton of information, you know, over a couple hundred updates a day that run through that page. And then what kind of stands out for you know, our trader subscribers is that there's a colorization feature too. So you know that it's a kind of a premium call that's being made. There's also audio alerts, you know, that you can trigger when calls are made. And then there's the other just non-colorized items that indicate that it's just, you know, general information that's not necessarily specific to the trader product, but might nonetheless help a trader subscriber make a decision or just be better informed about what's happening in the market that day.
Yep. Just to be clear to everybody that's listening, this is not an advertiser of ours. It's just that I am a very big user, a heavy user, and want you to check it out seriously, because it will, listen, not everything, there's different components. You don't have to go to the whole trader part of it. They have other components too. And then go over to their website. They have free trials. They have stuff that you could do. Just go over there. I'm not even an affiliate of theirs, right? I want you to just go right there and do your thing and find out more about it over briefing.com. So now what resources, what habits do you kind of rely on to stay ahead of the research in the markets?
Well, I'm going to, and to be upfront here, Andrew, you know, I manage the Briefing Investor product, and I'm constantly, you know, out there looking at all sources of information. But, you know, I'll probably bounce during the day between, you know, my FactSet terminal to the Wall Street Journal to Bloomberg to other you know, other websites, and then we have some proprietary sources we're able to be in contact with to help give us, you know, insight onto what they're hearing as well. So it's just really, it's kind of a, you know, what I tell entry-level employees to briefing.com that I might be training is it's kind of like you have to have your head on a swivel all day long, right? Because, because, you know, the market's dynamic, the news flow is constant, and the sources are innumerable, and you have to be able to kind of cut through the noise and also determine what's really a valid source, right? You know, we're very deliberate in terms of the things we do post to make sure they're coming from reputable sources. And, you know, in some cases, we want to make sure, you know, that the news is accurate by verifying it through two independent sources and not just taking what we get on the fly and you know, and going with it. So our users, you know that they can trust the information they're seeing on briefing.com. You know, we don't have any agendas. You know, we don't take political positions. We don't manage money. We don't take positions in the market as a business. So it's just, frankly, a professional and trustworthy site that has stood the test of time. And, you know, we were the pioneer in terms of providing live market analysis on the internet, over 30 years in business now, and very proud of that history, and look forward to making more history for many more years
to come. Good stuff. So I don't have to panic and have a nightmare is what you're saying.
That's right. So,
okay. All right. Let's talk about some things about the markets. So with your long and deep history, a lot of things going on right now, right? This is not, is it normal? Somebody said, is this normal? I'm like, well, I don't know. There's always these abnormal times that if you string them all together, makes everything normal, right? The whole totality of it, that's what normal is, that there's going to be these times, right? Well, you would go with that, right?
Sure. Yeah.
So what historical parallels do you see with today's market conditions to, I don't know, some, aside from 4 years ago, you know, besides that, what else? Yeah.
Well, you have, you know, if kind of just, I should say that, you know, if you look at the CBOE volatility index, right, you can say you're not in a normal period right now, right? But I know what you're driving at, right? It's like you have these periods, you know, they're episodic, where you have extreme volatility that is always associated with extreme sense of uncertainty, right? So, you know, if you're going back, like even to, you know, the dot-com days, right, and the financial crisis, you know, those are some things that sort of stand out as historical parallels in terms of the excessive volatility around major news events, and, you know, a little bit different than the dot-com situation, because that was, you know, that was a true, you know, bubble. And there was a lot of valuation angst there. And then, of course, you had the 9/11 factor in there as well, and the recession that, you know, coincided with that. The financial crisis was something, you know, that was frankly a lot scarier, I think, than anything we're seeing today. And then, of course, with COVID, that was, when you talk about an extreme level of uncertainty, well, that was it, you know, because we hadn't seen, you know, something like that in what, over 100 years. And but you could see some similar parallels as we talk about tariffs and trade wars and what have you, and disruptions to supply chains, right? That was clearly a factor in during those COVID days, was the disruption in the supply chains, which, you know, helped feed, you know, the high inflation that we saw. And so that's one of the fears that the market has on its mind right now. If these high tariff rates stay in effect, what that could potentially do to those supply chains around the globe, and how that could ultimately be transmitted through pricing mechanisms that could lead to much higher inflation, which nobody wants at this point, because we've seen it. You know, whole generation of investors, new generation of investors, got acquainted with high inflation and how dangerous that can be.
And what's interesting is already, we talk about the supply chain, 30% of all Chinese cargo ships have been canceled incoming. Potential for even further, forget tariffs. The fact that we're not getting goods, that's, right. You know, they've called it like an embargo. I think a Treasury that's Secretary right. Yeah. Bessent was talking about it with an embargo. He's talking about the unsustainability of this, because this is a problem. I hate to break it to everybody, but we get a lot of our goods from China. Hello. You know, and we like getting goods from China. I know everybody's like all pissed off at China, that, you know, we're pointing the finger at China. China's done a lot of good for us and the world. Let's all be honest about that, okay? For a lot of good reasons. Do we like the fact that they're stealing our stuff? No. Do we like the stuff that... But it happens all over the place. I'm sure we're stealing some of their stuff too. But, you know, we're looking 3 months out into the deep summer where shelves could be theoretically bare for a variety of material, for a variety of products.
Well, yeah, that's a very good point. And I think there was some conjecture yesterday that when the CEOs of Home Depot and Walmart and I think it was Target met with the president, kind of, you know, bring that to his attention, really, is the risk that's being run about being out of stock and because of the trade embargo. And, you know, when you have a 145% tariff rate on imported goods from China and China has a 125% tariff rate on imported goods from the U.S., there is no trade, right? It's just it's cost prohibitive. And so it's hard to think that there won't be some type of domino effect of that. And that is the real question hanging over the market right now is how quickly can there be a resolution and what will that resolution look like? And how much damage is going to be done in the interim before you get to that point of resolution? And there's just, it's just an unknowable factor.
But I think we do know there's going to be damage.
I think it's a safe assumption that yes, there will be some damage done. And that in some respects there already has been, you know, when the whole tariff situation came to light here in recent weeks and months, you saw some front running of those of purchases, right? And so a lot of you know, inventory was brought forward, and so there's going to be a payback period for that in coming months because you know they're just you're not going to have the same orders following through, and so so yes, there's. You know, you can start to, you're starting to hear a little bit of that even in the first quarter earnings calls, you know, companies trying to do what they can to mitigate the tariff impact, but also kind of putting out some wide guidance ranges if they're putting out any guidance at all to account for the likelihood that they'll see higher input costs, certainly the longer these tariff matters stay in place. And so, you know, you're working with a baseline tariff of 10% as it is. And so the question is, does that get removed or do you see that remain intact? And then we're talking about whatever, you know, premium there is relative to that 10% baseline. That's going to have an adverse impact.
You know, it's interesting, 10%. Let's just be clear about this. There's a talk about the tariffs are one-time inflationary number, right? One time. So it was like, right. Oh, okay, then it's only one time. Let me explain something for you. People, 10% is 3 to 4 years. In fact, at a 2% rate, which is the target rate by the Fed, that's a 5-year all-in-one inflation increase off the top that does not go away if the tariffs are permanent. In fact, I would lend this out to some ears. Even if the tariffs come off, I would venture prices don't come down. Thoughts?
Well, I think, yeah, right. That's, you know, you hear about it as being a one-time price adjustment, right? And, you know, I think we've seen here, even before this happened, right, is as we talked about inflation and the Fed talked about inflation coming down into the, you know, 2.5% range from where it was at, you know, 8-9%. It's better, but you still have inflation. And so one of the keys is going to be is, you know, what happens to, you know, real wages, right? Can mm-hmm. it keep up? Can it keep up with that? It's not going to keep up with 10%, certainly. So you already know right off the bat if that's going to be the permanent rate. At least, you know, you're going to have some issues in terms of end demand because there's just not going to be enough income, disposable income, for people to keep spending like they did when you know when they weren't dealing with that price adjustment.
Yeah, sure.
Right. It's not sounding like it's going to be a positive, and I don't think anyone's necessarily reading it as a positive right now.
Yeah, but they're trying to pacify us, right? There's all this that this is for the better good. By the way, have you heard of a plan yet of what the better good is? Like, what's the reason why we're supposed to give latitude to all of this in our thinking, because something on the other side, there's a rainbow, there's a pot of gold, there's something waiting for us, right? What is that? Because I haven't heard yet. Seriously.
Well, I mean, I think there's been an attempt to try and suggest that, you know, you're going to use this tariff money to help pay down, you know, the debt. And that, you know, that could ultimately translate into lower interest rates.
Okay. I'll go with that.
Potentially, right?
I'll go with that.
So, but you know, the thing of it is too, you have to take into consideration, you know, like China's been a big buyer of, you know, of our treasuries, right? Mm-hmm. And that's been kind of a consequence of the large trade deficit we do run with China. You know, they give us goods, we give them dollars, they reinvest those dollars in U.S. treasuries. And when you have this embargo like we have right now, that flow is not, I mean, it's theoretically, it's not happening, you know? And I think that, you know, it's one of those potential factors that could help explain why, you know, the 10-year note yield, for one, is, you know, staying elevated here. And, you know, that's going to be something you need to keep a close eye on. We know that the Treasury Secretary is keeping a close eye on it because mm-hmm. he's come out and said that, you know, one of the administration's objective is to get, you know, the 10-year yield down. You know, it's interesting. It's kind of like where it is right now today, around 4.3% or so. It's roughly right in the middle of the range we've seen since Inauguration Day and the lows we saw prior to Liberation Day. And so it's just sort of just kind of stuck there. And I think that that's emblematic of kind of how the market overall might be stuck for a while in these ranges until it really, you know, has a better handle on this situation and what types of resolutions are being presented.
With the fact that yields are where they are, with the fact that not moving right now, ranging from what, let's call it 3.7 to 4.8. Let's just say that's the, would you agree with that about the general range of 10-year?
Right. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Dollar at a multi-year low, which is kind of opposite of what most people thought. And that's why you were seeing such benefit given to ex-US assets, whether it's emerging market bonds, by the way, real estate, equities, they're all doing pretty well. In the developed international, emerging international, what sectors, and the other thing is, the best sectors this year, staples and utilities. So what mm-hmm. is that telling me? That's telling me if I see staples, utilities,
healthcare.
healthcare, energy, those, I mean, energy is not so good recently, but if I see those, that's the recession trade, isn't it? That's a slowdown trade.
That's right. That's right. You know, those are typically the sectors that you would see exhibiting relative strength in periods of economic weakness. Now, economic weakness can just be low growth or it can be an actual recession. But clearly, there's been a rotation there. But, you know, we're talking about, you know, the utility sector and the consumer staple sectors, they are up year to date. You know, every other sector is down. So mm-hmm. a lot of this relative strength is just measured in terms of what's down the least.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, no, I get that.
But to your point, I mean, you can make the case that there's definitely a more defensive oriented leaning in the market to this point in 2025 that would lead one to think that there's a lot of people betting on there being a slowdown.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that even was starting to take root before we saw this real tariff upset. And, you know, just kind of went to a different level, new level after that. But even things like you're seeing, you know, the high beta factor really get hammered this year versus the low volatility factor. Right. So you're seeing those types of more defensive oriented trades and who could forget gold, right?
Oh,
you know, gold's been flying.
Yep.
And while the dollar, as you mentioned, is at multi-year lows, it's fair to point out though, it's still, you know, pretty high, all things considered. I mean, we're still above levels that we saw, you know, at the peak ahead of the financial crisis in 2007, 2008. So, you know, you could make a case too, that, you know, the dollar weakness could ultimately, you know, be a help sorts for these U.S. multinationals.
Yep.
But of course, then on the flip side of that, you have this headwind of tariffs and trade issues abroad that could, you know, hurt demand for their sales abroad. And so, yeah, it's just kind of a no man's land right now.
So let's kind of look into policy and economic impacts in terms of what's your thoughts on the Fed, the current stance, how you see it evolving, where are we? We're in, first of all, I think I can't help but wonder if the browbeating of, as they call it, too late Powell and loser Powell, right? You saw those news items, right?
I did.
Which I thought was terribly disrespectful, by the way, just to be very clear about that. As a full disclosure, I have been very much a critic of the Fed, you know, saying they are too late. I think they're brilliant, but they're too late. Okay. But I think one of the things they're making a mistake is browbeating, because once you start browbeating the way they are, him making a move then looks political, which he doesn't want to happen, and that could backfire. But the point is, if you were the Fed, if you were, Jay Powell, what would you be doing?
Right. I'd be doing exactly what they're doing, right, at this point. You know, you're not going to be bullied into cutting rates, you know, just because. I think that there's, you know, the Fed officials are, you know, have history on their mind and are, you know, academics to a certain extent, in that they recognize that tariffs aren't inherently inflationary, you know, certainly in the near term, right? I think that, you know, they're conscientious that they were making progress toward getting back to that 2% target, but they weren't there yet. And now they've got this to stack on top of it, right? And you're even, you know, you kind of even heard it in the Beige Book report, right? Is that, you know, many companies are talking about raising prices to help offset the impact of tariffs. And we've seen, the soft data, right, in the Michigan sentiment report, I mean, you know, inflation expectations are just flying right now.
And sentiment's in the toilet.
That's right. And so I think that—
Actually, sentiment is lower than it was during the financial crisis and lower than it was during COVID, just to be clear.
Yeah. I read recently that, you know, the level of bearishness among individual investors has been above 50% for 8 straight weeks. And there's never been a streak like that going back to records that date back to 1987, according to the American Association of Individual Investors. And so, you know, one can make a case that that's a contrarian indicator. But in any event, the Fed is stuck right now, right? I think, you know, you can make, you know, that argument that you're going to see end demand drop off and see a real, you know, slowdown in growth that kind of helps tame inflation, perhaps. But this is a Fed that I don't think wants to be, wants to risk, you know, tempting history and seeing, you know, a rate cut followed by another big pickup in inflation, you know. And then you can imagine what the other side of that's going to be.
Oh,
is that, you know, that you'll get bullying from a different angle in terms of how the Fed made a, you know, a lousy move
let's be honest, they're in a no-win situation right now. And I don't think coming from I'm not the biggest lover of the Fed and how they do things. I think that with all the staff they have and all the things they do, they have made a lot of mistakes, and their economic forecasting is not the greatest. Mm-hmm. But again, they're there. If I was to say, how do they do in the job that I think they do, which is making sure things don't crack and be cheerleaders for the economic global economics entirely. I think they do a fine job of that.
I would agree. And like you, you know, I had written. Several pieces when, you know, they were sitting at the zero bound and still, you know, engaged fully with quantitative easing when the inflation rate, you know, was like 8%. So, you know, it just made zero sense. And that's a tough reputation to shake. And I think that that's another reason why the Fed, led by Jerome Powell anyway, is going to be way more deliberate here and making sure they don't, you know, make a similar mistake by cutting rates too soon.
What are you looking at? The Q4 earnings review of that, earnings outlook, in terms of, like, we've talked about this on and offline, but the idea that, hey, things are okay. As a matter of fact, David Solomon came out a few days ago, and he said something to the effect of, hey, you know what? Q1 in there, obviously, if we could just get, by the way, can we just get rid of the fiscal for once? Because it's very confusing. fiscal for this guy's Q1, for this guy it's Q4, for this guy it's Q2, right? But nonetheless, Q1, calendar Q1, it was okay, according to Goldman. Then he said something that was interesting. He said, whole different story Q2. Mm-hmm. And it kind of stopped the CNBC people. What do you mean? That's a lot what we're hearing. We saw that from Chipotle. We saw that from even IBM is cutting back. There's a lot of things happening of this cloudy, foggy uncertainty going on. Now, whether or not it is actual, we're about to see over the next couple of 3 weeks. But what is your sense of what's happening? Is it companies are like, hey, this is a great time to just, you know, pull our guidance because nobody cares? Or, you know, because they do that. And then they'll do a bunch of, you know, they'll be happy to take the stock down and then do buybacks. So what's your sense of how things were and where they're going?
Well, if we just start with Q4 real quick, you know, earnings were up 18% in the fourth quarter. So clearly
year over year, right.
S&P 500 earnings, right? just fantastic, right? Yeah, everything was going along just great. You know, first quarter, you know, we're still talking earnings growth so far, up at about 8% blended growth rate, according to FactSet. Now, that's down from a projected growth rate of close to 14% when the third quarter of 2024 ended, right? So we can see that things have been marked down, but it's nowhere, nothing close to, you know, recession type stuff, right? It's you know, 8% growth. I think if most years people would say, okay, that's decent, we'll take that. And you know, we're seeing the second quarter estimates come down a bit, but still positive, or about 6.9% based on the latest data from FactSet that I saw. Now that's down from 11.4% as of December 31st. So you can see how that's starting to kind of deteriorate a bit. But again, we're not talking about a contraction in earnings as it relates to the earnings estimates. Still positive. You know, in terms of what it means for the full year, I think that's what's got everyone playing a big guessing game. I think we recently saw Citigroup and Goldman Sachs take down their 2025 estimates in the neighborhood of like $250 to $255, I believe. But the current consensus estimate right now for the calendar year is just north of $264. So, you know, and that's down from about $272 at the start of the year. So not a huge decline really in terms, it's been about 3% or so from the start of the year. And I think that what's worked into the market's mindset is the recognition that those estimates probably are going to have to come down more. And because you still have a market that's not cheap. You know, we're trading.
We came off from what, 23 down to 19?
That's right. And today.
And by the way, I'm sorry to interrupt you. That means that means a forward PE, sorry, for the listeners, a PE multiple forward of 23 times. You take the earnings in totality of the S&P 500, let's just call it, I'm just going to pick a number, $100. You multiply that by 23, that means the S&P would be at 2,300. That's the number that works. 19 would be 1,900. Anyway, so now we came from a 23 multiple on forward times earnings to 19. I'm sorry, continue.
Right, and a little bit above 19 now with this rally we've seen over the past few sessions. I mean, we're up about 7% low to high over the last 2.5 sessions. But, you know, the five-year average is 19.9. The 10-year average is 18.3. So we're trading at a premium still to the 10-year average. And, that seems a little bit out of touch in terms of what's going on. And I think that's the worry. That's why you're seeing, I think, this inclination to sell into strength these days, as opposed to a real willingness to buy into the weakness, which is what carried the market in 2024, right? Every dip was bought, right? There was no fear of buying a dip. And there is that fear now, given this uncertainty factor. But, so I think what the market needs to see is these, you know, these rebound efforts stabilize and then move up from there, as opposed to basically being sold into right away. But I think there's a real concern that the estimates are going to come down, and therefore there's not a real willingness to pay up for those earnings right now with the lack of visibility.
Yeah. Let's skip over to Eco for a second. Interesting, the labor market. So the big concern is the worst case scenario, oh my, stagflation, which happens once every, you know, blue moon, literally. Mm-hmm. But everybody likes to talk about it. We talk about it a lot, but it doesn't happen, right? Stagflation.
Right.
And the idea of stagflation is high unemployment and high inflation, right? Two bad things. You're out of a job and now you got to pay more for things. Very bad. Okay. The labor market, interestingly enough, the last couple of 3 weeks or so, when you saw some of these, even the layoffs from Doge, the Thursday morning initial claims, 220, 210, mm-hmm. like it's still pretty strong. Like nothing's moving in a bad way.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's actually three factors when it comes to stagflation, not just two. There's low growth, you know, there's the low growth situation, there's high inflation, and then there's rising unemployment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, the unemployment rate right now is at 4.2%. Again, if you didn't know anything that was going on and you just got back from Mars and you were told that the unemployment rate's 4.2%, be like, wow, things are really, really cooking. And it's an important component. Now that unemployment rate is a lagging indicator. So I'm glad you brought up the initial claims numbers because those are leading indicators.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is, pacified the market a bit here, you know, as we, you know, here in the market narrative, the talk of possible recession and all bad things happening economically, but you're not seeing it in the initial claims data. You know, like you mentioned, we had initial claims reading around 220,000, the 4 week average, not very far from that. And, you know, when you look at past recessions, right, you had the 4 week average for initial claims, you know, probably run, you know, north of 400,000, right? So we've got a long way to go in terms of that, what you could possibly get to if you're going to, you know, be talking recession type figures. And I think that was a pacifying issue here to recognize that, you know, with the low level of initial claims, there's a willingness to believe or embrace that people will continue to spend here because they're gainfully employed. That doesn't mean they won't slow some of their spending as they worry a little bit more about job security and the cost of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing in the data on the employment side right now that is really scary sounding. But again, you just have this unnerving feeling that and the market does that it, you know, you might see a quick inflection point on that front. And again, it's worried that when you see what's happening in the sentiment readings, you know, there's worries about a potential carryover into the hard data, which hasn't been seen yet. But the worry is there that could ultimately lead into a retrenchment in spending that obviously creates a big hit to GDP, earnings prospects, employment in as well. So keeping an eye out for all those things.
One of the things we do know that you don't want to bet against the consumer in the United States. You don't want to bet against the economy in the United States. I mean, we are very resilient. A lot of times we'll buy when we're really happy and we'll buy stuff when we feel like crap. You know, it's like, oh man, I'm depressed. Let me go buy myself a new TV. You know,
yeah.
you know, I'm really feeling like crap. Let's go out for a really big all-you-can-eat dinner. You know,
right.
I mean, it's that kind of thing. And the same thing on the other side, right? Hey, things are great. Let's celebrate. Let's go buy yourself two TVs. Or, you know, so the point is that there's this resilience because we like to spend. We are an economy. Honestly, you know, we look at service, we like manufacturing, but really at the heart of what we are as United States, as from an economic standpoint, is we're spenders. That's what we do. That's what,
no doubt
about it. That's what we help
the
mm-hmm. world with, right? We travel, we eat, we drink, we go, we get stuff, we buy stuff, we buy more stuff. You know, it's Christmas every day in my office. I have more stuff coming from Amazon every single day. I'm like, oh, what can I even, you know, it gets bad when you're like, I wonder what that is. I don't remember ordering something.
Now let me, just as an aside, I don't know if you are you familiar with the comedian George Carlin?
Yeah, sure.
All right. Well, Google his bit on stuff.
Yeah, right.
And you'll get a good laugh out of that.
Yep, exactly. All right, what else do we want to talk about? I think we covered a lot of this. Housing market. Housing market's interesting, right? So we saw the lowest level recently in sales and pending starts and blah, 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 blah. It was like all of a sudden out of nowhere, literally out of nowhere, the housing, the Lennars, the KB Homes, the Pulte's, they rolled over hard. I mean, hard. Mm-hmm. What's also interesting, here's a little something. Here's a little Bernard Baruch kind of shoe shine kind of discussion. I think it was, well, that goes, it depends on who you look at and who actually said it, but that's the one I read. An Uber driver said, you know what? You need to short the cruise lines and the airlines because foreigners aren't coming in because they can't, they have a real concern about when they come in that they are going to be somehow either held up, deported, or incarcerated. And they're not going on cruises because there's so much uncertainty and blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. So, but we see them roll over. The Darlings, I didn't understand why, but the Darlings, Norwegian Carnival, right? Last year was like, hey, look at these stocks go. Right. The airlines were like, Delta last year was like, how is that even possible? Mm-hmm. Right? It looked like a rocket ship, much like versus an airline. That those all rolled over. Anything happening in the housing market that's going to actually take it down any further from where we are now? Because it's still a shortage.
Well, what could take it down further would be, higher mortgage rates, right? And again, that's kind of why I mentioned a little bit earlier, you got to keep a close eye on that 10-year note yield. It's not perfectly aligned with mortgage rates, but it's a benchmark for mortgage rates. They tend to follow the movement of that 10-year note. That would be one thing, right? Just another thing, of course, would be a pickup in unemployment. That's further slows the housing market. The issue it's that the market's confronted with though is really affordability constraints driven by higher prices for both particularly for existing home sales. Right, it was interesting with the March existing home sales report that we saw out Thursday. Every region saw a decline in home sales year over year, right? But every region also saw an increase in the median selling price year over year. And, that when that gets paired along with these, relatively high mortgage rates, it brings in affordability constraints. And the existing home market is also supply constrained. There was a 4-month supply at the current sales pace. And in a more balanced market, you'd see about a 6-month supply. Now, looking at new home sales, that supply situation seems to be a lot better. You have an 8.3-month supply right now. But you're still seeing, prospective buyers a little bit reluctant to spend here because even though prices have been coming down or some on the new home market, you still have the higher mortgage rate to contend with, and you're seeing that reflected in sales that have kind of stalled here of late, and just have an overall housing market. It's probably important to keep in mind though that existing home sales account for like over 90% of home sales, so new home sales is a smaller sliver of things. So you really have to, I think, concentrate on that existing home sales market to get a bead on the total housing picture. And it's not a good look right now.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Pat O'Hare from briefing.com. The information on how to get in touch with you would be over on and briefing, and make sure people get your trial subscription and check it out. It's like pickleball. As soon as you play pickleball, you're addicted. As soon as you get briefing.com, you're addicted. I'm telling you something. So just, if you don't want to be addicted, fine. But if you really want good quality, it's the place. It's the place. Briefing.com. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode number 918. The show notes will have links in there also to briefing.com. So you can find that. Pat, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Andrew. Appreciate the kind words about briefing.com.
My pleasure. All right, see you soon. That's going to wrap it up for this week. We got Pat O'Hare that just did a great job right there from Briefing. Next week, we have Dan Pila talking about taxes and all sorts of really interesting things. Don't miss that, especially when it comes to some planning for next year, some things that I think we're going to have to be aware of. Dan Fajella is coming up. He's always interesting at Easterling. And then Tom Nelson to wrap out, one of the lead guys from Franklin Templeton. All coming up on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Thanks for joining me again. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.